You're listening to episode 9 of season 6 of The GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu and this is The GNU World Order. This is my little show about GNU and Linux and Unix and all manners of technical things. So in this episode we're going to be talking about, well, actually a lot of things, Synfig Studio, animation application for GNU Linux. Publican, we'll talk about that a little bit. Windows and OS X, we'll talk about both of those, but we'll, of course, tie it all back to Linux and Unix in the end. Maybe mention Fedora, talk about Autour, talk about upcoming Linux Fests again, and, another Fat Chance Lester album has been released. So, let's get started. So first, let's talk a little bit about Publican, and I know that I've covered all kinds of things about text editing and document publishing and stuff like that. But this is a really cool little program that I've recently gotten into, and I really got excited about it, a lot more excited than I expected to get about it. So I really want to talk about it. So if you don't do any publishing and you don't do any text editing that you ever want to print or publish in any way, bear with me. But otherwise, this might be a tool that you want to look at. Publican is essentially a front end to DocBook, but also to publishing with DocBook, if you will. So it's not just a front end to DocBook, because as I've said, DocBook is a markup language. It's hard to kind of have a front end to a markup language. More than that, Publican is a method of using DocBook, and it's really an application in itself. It's a line command-based application, so it's not something that you're going to open up and click around, but it's a full suite of tools that you can use on the command line to help you release books having been written in DocBook. I myself have a front end to DocBook the same way that Publican does. I described this front end, although I wasn't really thinking of it as a front end at that time, but now that I see Publican, I realize that that's essentially what I had. I described this at the end of season 5, and I think again in the beginning of season 6. And it's essentially, hey everyone, structure your DocBook documents this way, use this little line command to format it, and then use XML2, and then push it to FOP, and then push that to PDFTK, and you're done. And so it's a series of little line commands, and it's cool because that's the Unix ideal, right? You've got lots of little tools that you can string together, and it works. It works really quite well, and if you ever need to see how that works, then you could look at some of the older Git commits in Slacker Media, because Slacker Media used that methodology, and I've used it in 2 or 3 books since. But I've definitely used the workflow, and it's worked. So Publican features a lot of different things, but one of them is a very, very pretty schema. They use it on the Red Hat documentation, on the Fedora documentation, I think on GIMP, JBoss, and GNOME documentation. So a lot of different projects. And so if you've ever seen documentation from any of these projects, like the official documentation, then you know the schema already. It's got the nice little breakout boxes for the notes and the importance, you know, the little warnings. It's got the nice colored text for, like, the headings, and it's got little branding pictures up in the top left corner or the right corner, whatever. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go to slackermedia.info, either download the EPUB or the PDF of the book, or just go and look at the book online. That was all now, as of like 2 weeks ago, generated with Publican. So it's a really, really attractive schema. Technically speaking, you could steal those schema out of Publican and just do all of your DocBook publishing your own way with XML2 and FOP. And instead of using the default DocBook schemas, you could always just use the new fancy Publican schemas. I find it kind of convenient, though, to be able to just issue Publican build HTML PDF and have it take care of all those steps for me, which is just really, really cool. But Publican is its own workflow, and it's its own entity, and it really is an application, and it's easy to install. It's yum install Publican, or apt-get install Publican, whatever. On Slackware, there's no Slack build, there's no Slack package for it, and essentially this is because in order to install Publican, you have to install a whole bunch of Perl modules, like a lot. Now, I started a little script that was going to be an installer for Publican, but at a certain point, I just thought that it was kind of weird to be writing a script that simply has a dozen or 2 dozen Perl-mcpan-e quote install so-and-so module time and time and time again. So I think that if you're going to install it on Slackware, then it'll probably be just as easy to just do it yourself. It's not the most fun thing in the world, but CPAN to some degree takes care of a lot of dependencies for you. So if you do a Perl mcpan e install, then you can knock it out in a couple of commands. I still might develop this script just as a quick and dirty method, but if you really want to do it the right way, you'll do all the Perl installs, and then you'll install the source of, well, you have to have FOP installed first, and you have to have XML2, I think, installed as well, and then you have to install, you'll want to install public and from source, because the way I did it, which was the lazy way of doing it on one Slackware machine that I had, was just download the RPM from the Fedora repository, turn that into a Slack package with RPM2TGZ, and then do an install PKG, publican whatever .TGZ. That worked fine, except that the location of all the Perl modules is different in Slackware than it is on Fedora. So the Fedora RPM, or publican in general, I guess, the way that it was set up to be installed from that RPM, assumes that publican.pm is going to be in one folder, and it's not. So I had to go and patch publican. Yes, I patched a perfectly fine application with a line of code of my own to get it to work. Probably there's a million reasons why I shouldn't be doing that, but I did it anyway, and it works. And it was a simple little line in the publican script itself, which is in like user bin, which of course on Slackware, if you do it the right way, you would be putting it in user local bin. So that's kind of weird right there. But it was just the line begin, curly bracket push at inc, comma, quote, slash user, slash share, slash Perl 5, slash end quote, semicolon, curly bracket. Put that at the top of the publican script that publican is. It's just a big Perl script. And then it changes the path, essentially, of where Perl is going to look for its modules, and it changes that to the user share slash Perl 5. Folder. And then it can find publican.pm, and then you can use publican. So that's a really bad way to do it, and so I was taking shortcuts, and I guess I kind of paid for it in the end. So I would say if you're going to do it on Slackware, just install the Perl modules and then build publican from source from there. But of course, you'll also need all the dependencies like FOP and XML2, and probably some font files. So I mean, on any system, I mean, if you do a yum install or an apt-get install, you're going to see that publican is, it's a pretty hefty application in terms of what it needs to work. Mainly, it's just a whole bunch of Perl, but it needs a lot of XML tools as well, including some SVG XML kind of converters and just all kinds of stuff. But it's very cool. So after you get it installed, you can issue the initial command to create a book, and that is publican create dash dash name double quote, I don't know, GNU World Order, end double quote. And that will create a skeleton, a folder, and inside that folder there will be the skeleton of a book. Now, if you don't want to do a book and you just want to do an article or something like that, then you can specify that as well with a dash dash edition equals. You can do book or article. You can specify a product name, a brand that you want to use, a language that you're going to be doing this in. Lots and lots of different things. Most of them I frankly don't really know much about because I don't do much of that stuff other than the book part. So in the directory that you just created, which let's say we just did GNU World Order, so it would be GNU underscore world underscore order. It parses the spaces that you set and makes some underscores for you. So if you changed directory into that, you would then see the default publican.config file, or it's publican.cfg, and an en-us, because the default language, at least on a system that has the locale set as enus probably, would be enus. And if you go into the en-us folder, then you see the basic, really, really just kind of the bare minimum stuff that a book requires. And one of those is the author group, one of them is the book info, and then there's a sample chapter and a preface and a revision history and things like that. So and an images folder, different things like that a book is going to require anyway. If you start from this skeleton, you'll actually be pretty well set to go. If you just kind of look at the chapter file, if you've never seen DocBook before, this is a fair little intro to it. It's a little bit complex. It's got a lot of tags in it, and it gives IDs to all the different tags. So, I mean, it looks, it's not sparse, you know, it's pretty well populated. But it I think it's a pretty good start for people who maybe aren't used to DocBook all that much. There is the GNUWorldOrder.ent, which is the entity. This is used in different places throughout the book, and so you're going to want to set that. It's a holder entity by default, and if you were to publish it at just the bare skeleton of it, you would see some, I think it says, like, you need to change the holder entity in the enus/GNUWorldOrder.ent file. So it's something that you are going to want to change. And, of course, there's the preface, which you might want to put sort of a summary into, and the author group. You might want to put the different authors involved in there. So it's a pretty cool little intro to, hey, here's how to start a book. So once you've written your book, and the way that I do it, still, because I don't like, especially when it's getting marked up and there's going to be revisions and stuff like that, I don't like big mammoth files that contains all of my chapters. So I actually go in and name each chapter something. So chapter1.xml, chapter2.xml, chapter3.xml, rather than just saying, okay, this is my chapter file and it's chapter.xml and it's got all my chapters in it. I just don't think that's practical, because in my experience, in my limited experience, I'm sure, you're moving chapters around all the time, you're juggling them around, and if you have to do that within a text document, I just see you scrolling way too much, and I can't be bothered to do that. So I divide my chapters into their own individual files, and then I go into whatever the title is. It's, for instance, in this case, like I said, it's GNU_world_order.xml, and that exists for you, and that's essentially the build file. It's got everything. It has what's called XI includes, or XI includes. I've always heard it said XI include, and the XI includes are external files of this file that you want to include in your book. So it's almost like a make file or something. So it's got XI include href book_info.xml, and then include href preface, and then chapter, and then revision history. So if you just add lines for each of the chapters, like chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, chapter 5, and then you could, of course, again, you can reorder them there if you ever want to, and then whenever you build your book, Publican looks at that file and builds your book according to what order you've got all of your stuff in, which is something important to notice and know about, because if you sit there and you're making, you know, you assume that the chapter.xml is just a sample chapter, and so you model your other chapters after that, and then you publish, and you're, lo and behold, your book only has one chapter, and it's the sample chapter, and you're wondering, gee, why isn't it building all of my chapters? Well, the reason would be that it's not in your GNU World Order, or your title of, you know, your great book .xml. The title of your book .xml is the make file or the build file for the actual work. Okay, so speaking of building, how do you build on Publican? Quite simple. You simply back out into the main directory where you've got the en-us and the publican.config file. Well, technically you could do it from another place as well, but I like to do it from here because that way all the config stuff is just kind of automatically found. And you type in publican build, and then the formats that you want to build to. You can do PDF, you can do HTML, and get this, EPUB. Yes, you can do one single line command publishing to EPUB. It's fantastic. It's really, really exciting, in fact. It's a killer feature. But beside the prettiness of Publican, besides the very attractive schemas that they use, getting to just go straight out to EPUB is extremely, extremely powerful stuff. If you want to publish to EPUB, this is absolutely one of your best options. I frankly don't even know what is processing it to EPUB. I don't believe it's FOP, because as far as I know, FOP doesn't do EPUB yet. So it might be one of the Perl scripts that Publican uses that's doing that kind of magic. I'm really not sure. I frankly don't care. It just looks so great. And it makes EPUB so easy. Before I found Publican, I was going to have to, you know, I was trying to figure out how to get it out to EPUB, and I was like, well, maybe I could just get Calibre, or people seem to say it Calibre, load my PDF into that, and then export it as an EPUB. I didn't really love the idea of that, because I kind of had the feeling that an automagical converter like that probably isn't doing everything the very best of ways. You know, I don't know, because I haven't looked at the back end of Calibre at all, but I had a weird feeling about doing it that way, you know, taking my DocBook, getting it into PDF, and then getting the PDF and transferring it to EPUB felt weird. But taking my DocBook straight out to EPUB, that seems a little bit more kosher, and this is the way to do it, Publican. So Publican build PDF, or HTML or EPUB, whatever, looks at your default publican.config file there in your directory. You can also specify it with a --config and then specify where your config file is, and it builds it for you. And it's as simple as that. Now, the first few times, I can almost guarantee you're going to come up with some XML errors. That's just life in DocBook. It's life in XML. Anyone who works in XML will tell you that that's quite common. Just go through and fix the errors and try again. Like I've said many times before, Emacs in XML mode, it's fantastic stuff. But anyway, Publican is really, really attractive. Check it out on slackermedia.info if you want to see a sample, or just go do any kind of web search for Red Hat documentation. That's your best bet. Some of the Fedora documentation uses it, but you also see Fedora documentation that I guess maybe hasn't been ported to Publican yet or something, so it might not be what we're talking about. But the Red Hat documentation, all the Red Hat documentation I've seen uses it, so at least the modern stuff, like 5 and 6, RHEL 5 and 6. So if you can find that, you'll see that too. But otherwise, just look at Slacker Media. It was all done with Publican as of 2 weeks ago. I just took all my sources, ported it, as it were, over to Publican, and it looks fantastic. And now it's available as an EPUB, so you can go get it as an EPUB and have it on your phone or your portable media device, whatever. Okay, so that's probably enough about text editing and publishing and things like that for a while. So let's talk about a two-dimensional animation application for GNU Linux. That, of course, would be Synfig, Synfig Studio. Synfig Studio is currently on 0.62.2.2, I think, and it is a fine application. Really, really nice. If people come to you and ask you about animation software on GNU Linux, this is probably the one to tell them about. I realize that Blender can do two-dimensional animation. I've actually seen some great real pieces that were done on Blender, and it was just traditional two-dimensional animation. I thought it looked fantastic. However, a lot of their tool set is specifically made with three-dimensional animation in mind, right? So recommending that for a two-dimensional animator might be, one, overkill, and two, it might be giving them a set of completely unfamiliar tools. Synfig Studio at least looks and feels a lot more like software applications that you're going to find on other platforms, namely Toon Boom Studio, Animate Studio, or something like that, and Flash, and even to some degree Motion by Apple. So there are some very, very familiar things going on in Synfig. First of all, there's a timeline with a very traditional timeline that you can count in frames or in SMPTE timecode, and this timeline has a couple of different views, and there's the keyframe view, I guess you would call it like a node view, or I guess a child-parent view, and a parameter view. So each view is going to tell you different things. One will tell you the frames that are considered keyframes. One is going to tell you what elements within a larger group you can move. And another one is going to tell you all the, let's say, attributes or parameters of the things that you can animate or set differently. It's very familiar to anyone who's used, well, even like After Effects or Apple Motion. There's a lot of similarity there. I should say Toon Boom as well, and probably Flash, although I haven't looked at Flash in such a long time, it's hard for me to recall. The canvas in Synfig is defined by a fairly well-hidden menu. I have to say their menu structure really took me by surprise. I had no idea they had menus. But if you right-click on the canvas, you get contextual menus. So if you've got something in your canvas and then realize that you kind of need a menu, and you start right-clicking, you don't get... But in fact, up in the left-hand corner, right at the meeting point of the two rulers, there's a little dot or a caret depending on what theme you've got applied to Synfig Studio. And if you click on that, sure enough, you get a file, edit, view, canvas, tool, group, layer, and keyframe menu. So that's where their menus are. It is hidden, but it does exist. And if you go into the edit menu and into the properties, then you get all the different attributes of your project. So you've got a name, a description, and then you've got three tabs, image, time, and other. And typically the thing that you're going to really want to control, well, I guess image, first of all, because that would be the size of your actual canvas. Like 480 by 270 is its default, I think, but you could obviously up that to, for instance, 720 by 480 or 720 1080p or 1080, whatever you want to animate in. The time is particularly important because that's going to set how many frames you're going to be dealing with and how many frames per second you'll be dealing with. So the normal rate would be 24 frames per second for sync sound, and then your start time would be 00:00:00:00:00. That would be 0 hours, 0 minutes, 0 seconds, and 0 frames. And then your end time by default is going to be 5 seconds, 00:00:00:00:500. And you can change that more or less as needed. So I usually knock it down to 2 seconds because I'm really just starting out in the animation world in terms of making my own animation. So 2 seconds, of course, would give you 48 frames, right? 24 frames per second, 2 seconds, 48 frames. Animation typically happens in groups of two. You don't actually have one frame per frame, you essentially have 2 frames per frame. In other words, rather than drawing 24 frames per second, you draw 12 and you still have your playback rate at 24 frames per second, simply because 24 frames per second is what it evens out to if you want your sound and your picture to be synchronized. You need to have it 24 frames per second playback. But in terms of your actual drawing workload, it's 12 drawings per second, and less if you play your cards right. So you've set up your sequence then, and it's fairly self-explanatory at that point. You, in your timeline, you've got a little playhead, and you can position that at, for instance, 00:00:00:00:00. You click on your keyframe view, and you can add a new keyframe. And you'll see it listed right there in your little timeline, 00:00:00:00:00:00. Right now it's the length of 0 frames. And there's a jump link, so that once you have like 80 different keyframes, you can jump right to them quickly with just a click. And that would be your first frame, right? So you would draw some shape, maybe a circle. And there's a tool for that, and it's a circle tool. And you could draw that circle on the left side of the screen. And then you would progress maybe 2 frames over, you'd make a new keyframe, and you could progress that circle over a little bit. Now, in Synfig, in order to get to record movement, you need to be in animation mode. And I know this is directly analogous to Apple Motion. I don't know if it's analogous to anything else. I mean, I'm sure it is, but I don't know what else it would be analogous to. But the button for that in Synfig is on the lower right-hand corner. And on the one that I've installed on Slackware, which I think was built from Source, if my memory serves correctly, it's a green button. And when you hit it, it turns red, and there becomes a red border around your canvas. So it's very noticeable when you're in animate mode. Now, that means that whatever you do in this mode is going to be set down into the keyframes that you create. It's being recorded. If you're not in this mode, then you can change things all you want, but it's not going to be occurring. It's not actually going to happen in your keyframes. It's just something that you're doing to the drawing itself, if that makes any sense. So you could sit there and animate a circle across the screen all you want all day. If you're not in animate mode, you're not changing the frame. You're simply changing the drawing. It's important to understand the difference, and it becomes pretty apparent pretty quickly, because even if we've just made 2 keyframes, just like we did, you take that circle and you drag it over a little bit, then all the frames have the circle in the new location. There's been no perceptible movement. It's moved throughout all the different frames. A couple of different applications have different ways of doing this. This, like I say, is the motion version of when to record keyframe movement. And I think Final Cut does it that way too. The other option would be to have a tool property that says, make this change occur throughout all frames. That's what Toon Boom Animate does. But that's not what happens here, so you need to turn the animate button on. It's very nice because everything turns red when you do that. Your timecode display turns red, your canvas gets a red border, the button starts is now red rather than green, so it's huge. You can definitely tell when you're in animate mode and when you're not. So you click that button, you become in animate mode, and then you can go to the first keyframe, position your circle where you want it to be, go to your second keyframe, position your circle where it should be, and then go 2 more frames, make a new keyframe, and move your circle again. And now if you scroll back, you'll see for sure that you're moving the circle, and so on. You simply keep doing that. And that's all it is. That's all there is to it. You're animating now. That's so easy, isn't it? Don't you wonder why animators always complain that they have a hard job? It's super easy. It's a great little application. I'm going to go out of animate mode now, and I can scroll through. I can see the animation. It looks great. It's just beautiful movement. And there you go. That's Synfig Studio in a nutshell. Other things to note and be aware of, I guess, are that SynFig Studio is, of course, vector-based, so you're dealing with weird things like Bezier curves and B-lines and all these other things that are confusing if you've only ever used, for instance, GIMP or something like that, or a bitmap paint program. Very, very difficult. But if you've ever used Inkscape, then that'll make this a little bit easier. Again, there's this new layer of, well, now I'm used to Inkscape, so now I don't understand SynFig Studio, because it does things differently. And it's true, it does do things differently. I knew about SynFig Studio for quite some time and could not understand it until I saw my digital cell animation teacher using Toon Boom, and he was showing us on his computer on the screen how to manipulate all the drawing tools in Toon Boom. Turns out that they're very, very similar in SynFig. So things like the fact that the outline is it's a completely different entity from the fill. It's completely different than Inkscape. You know, in Inkscape you draw a circle and you can give it a stroke or not, and if you grab one part of that circle and you drag it across the Inkscape screen, the whole thing comes with it. In SynFig, you can drag the outline of a shape around and the fill does not follow it. So it's very, very disturbing at first, but if you're used to it, then you can understand how the two relate, and it doesn't seem so odd anymore. Another weird thing about it is the move nodes. So if I draw a circle, for instance, in SynFig, then my move node is a green little dot smack dab in the middle of the circle. That seems pretty normal and pretty easy to deal with. The weird thing about it is that in a line, like if you get your draw shape tool and then you get your move tool, click on your new shape, the green dot that you're looking for to move your shape around just defaults to the very middle of your canvas. Your shape might be way over off to the left. The green move node is in the middle of the canvas, and it took me about 3 days to figure out that it was always in the middle of the canvas. I would have sworn up until literally earlier yesterday, because I was complaining about how random it was, and then I kept looking and I realized that it was continually showing up in the middle of the canvas the first time you selected it, and then it stays relative to the picture from that point on. So not completely indecipherable, it's just different. It's different than what you might be used to. Another thing that's a little bit different is that, again, in Inkscape, you select a shape and then you go to its little color properties and stuff, and you click a color swatch, and that color and that shape turns to that color. Well, in this animation program, that doesn't happen. And you can sit there and you can select your shape all you want, and you can click on all these swatches, and you'll drive yourself crazy, and you're wondering, why isn't this changing color? Well, the fact is that you have to fill it in with a paint bucket. And again, that's actually a lot like this other, what's it called? Animation, Toon Boom Animation Studio thing. Same kind of deal. So I don't know how much of this is completely new and different for experienced animators and how much of it is just completely new and different for me, but I have a feeling it's mainly me, because I do remember Flash, and I think it was, what was that one application called? Fireworks, I think? It was by Macromedia, and Adobe still supports it and still releases it, but no one actually uses it. I think it's called Firework or something like that. Something like that. It's kind of funny. But anyway, it's got its own little way of doing things, and SynFig follows that tradition rather than, for instance, the Inkscape tradition, which is fine. It's just something to get used to. Really, really cool animation, though. I mean, really, really cool application for animation. You should absolutely check it out and recommend it to your friends. If anyone says that they're looking for animation software, this is the way to go. This is a really nice little animation package. Highly recommended. It's a pleasure to use once you actually understand more or less how to use it. So, fun stuff. And please do check it out. Okay, I think we should take a coffee break now. That was a lot of work all before one coffee break, so this is a much-deserved coffee break. I am drinking Ethiopia Yirgacheffe coffee, and it is really, really good. So I'm hoping that you're having a great cup yourself, and in a moment we will continue the episode. Yes, this is actually a really good cup of coffee, and I mean, this isn't going to be like a new segment, like, oh, let's hear Klaatu and what kind of coffee he's drinking. I'm not into that, but I have to say that this is a good cup of coffee. It's from Ethiopia, apparently, and it's from some place called Koke Farm, or Koke Farms, or something like that, and it is called, and I know that I'm not pronouncing this correctly, but it is Yirgacheffe, or Yirgacheffe. I'm not really sure. It's Yirgacheffe. No clue. It's not something that I went out and sought out. It was something that someone gave to me as a payment for fixing their computer. And they gave me this big bag of it, and it's really, really good. It's kind of got an earthy flavor to it, if you think of like the coffees that you have tasted. It's kind of a mild coffee. I'm not really big on the really dark, strong coffees so much. So it's somewhat mild, not super mild, but it's fairly mild, and yet it's still very rich, and it has this weird kind of like earthy flavor. I don't know how else to describe it. It's not acidic, you know, it's just really smooth and really, really good. So if you get a chance to try it, you might want to try it. I don't know really why you would happen across it, but if you do have a chance to try it, go for it. It actually reminds me a little bit, and this could be completely in my mind, but it reminds me a little bit of my old favorite, Sawtooth Mountain Mud, which of course I don't have any of anymore because I'm not anywhere near where that was sold. So that was coffee. Oh yeah, so the coffee actually it was like I said, a payment for fixing someone's computer, and it's not actually fixing. Someone had bought a computer, a Dell, and he brought it to me saying that he wanted to wanted help setting it up. And I open it up, of course, and just as I expected, it was a Windows computer. And this is not the kind of person who you would turn to and say, well, this is Windows, I don't use Windows, because I don't think that they don't understand that much. You know, it's like, well, you know how there are Macs and there are Windows. Well, I only use Linux, and then they're, you know, you just, by this time, they're just, you're way, way past them. So I said, okay, sure, I'll set it up for you. Like, my second time in my life ever even touching Windows, but I figure, how hard can it be? And, you know, aside from the crash that happened the very first time I started the computer, and that's not a slam on Windows, that's just literally there was a crash when I started it up. Like, I created the user or whatever, and I logged in, and the thing crashed. I think it was because there was just all these, like, windows that suddenly opened from, like, Dell about how, like, you had to back up your data and stuff. And, of course, at this point, there is no data to back up. You don't have data yet. You've just turned on the computer. So why they're crashing the computer in order for you to back up all of your vital, important information, not really sure about. But yeah, it did crash. I had to turn it off, turn it back on. And then after that, I just did, you know, I mean, the sort of like that same kind of thing that we've all done. You know, you take your friend's computer and you install all the free and open source software you possibly can that you think that they will use. And that is exactly what I did. You know, obviously Firefox got installed right away so that I wouldn't have to surf the internet on Internet Explorer. So Firefox was first to get on there, and then OpenOffice, and then FileZilla, Celtix, because this is a multimedia environment that I work in, so I figured there's a high chance of them needing a screenplay writing software. Emacs, of course. Actually, you know what? Emacs I couldn't quite get installed because I downloaded it, but I didn't know where to put the binary in order for it to open, so I had to leave that one off. But there were lots of little free applications that I installed, and it essentially was just, I just went through my sort of mental checklist of all the macOS free applications the free applications that I install on a macOS box. I just modified that and just downloaded, you know, VLC, things like that. So it was a really easy, quick job. It's really funny how easy it is to install most software on Windows, actually. You download the little .exe extension file on the internet, and it downloads it, and then it, like, offers to run the application for you, and you're like, yes, and it just does it. It installs it. Like, it's so fast. It's so easy. It's really, really funny, actually. This really kind of freaked me out, actually, because I was just like, wow, this is so easy to install stuff straight from the internet. No wonder people write viruses that you install when you get, like, a wallpaper. I mean, your Windows is almost begging people to do that. It's like, please exploit this weakness, because it's just too easy. It's really, I mean, it would be almost a shame if you're going to write a Windows application, it would be a shame not to use this to your advantage. It's just so easy. Of course, on the opposite end of the spectrum, there's OS X and the brilliant kind of, well, it's boiling down to being a bug at this point, where they are kind of doing a quasi-Windows thing where it sort of warns you that, hey, this is an application that you have downloaded from the internet. Of course, what, this day and age, everything you install is from the internet, right? I mean, how often is something not installed from the internet? So there's this big pop-up window every time you install something. Hey, this is installed from the internet. Are you sure you want to open this? And you say open or okay. And then for a while there, before a fairly recent update, they call it, they don't call it a bug fix because there are no bugs in Apple software. It's an update. It would keep telling you that. It would forever. You could not turn it off unless you log in as the big admin user of the computer and say, yes, it's okay for this application to run. You don't have to tell us every time we launch it that it was downloaded from the internet. So that was an interesting little thing. And now it just does that once and you say okay and then it doesn't bug you about it anymore, in theory. And of course, the sub-bug to that, see, in OS X, even though there aren't any bugs, you've got bugs, and then you've got sort of corollary bugs. So the corollary bug to that is that if you install something as the admin user, or rather, if you're not the admin user and you install something, it pops open a little thing to authenticate, right? It says, hey, you're not the admin user, why don't you authenticate? So you put in the admin user's name and the password, and you install it. So you're essentially doing a su, or a sudo, right? I mean, that's kind of what you're doing. So you're installing the application, you're having temporary write permissions to the applications folder, and then you put in the license code for your proprietary software that you're most certainly installing, and wouldn't you know, you don't have permission to write that license code out to where it wants to be written to. I mean, sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. It depends on the application. In some cases, like, unless you can get the admin user to log in as the admin user, like, physically change login to the admin user, log out and log back in, and put in the license code again, then you get to keep the license code. But if you log out and then log back in as a different user, you might not be able to keep that license code. This stuff kind of got me to think about the methods of installing on Linux. And I still maintain that the way to install software is from source code. I love it. I'm all about installing from source code. And if we think about the different methods of installing, we've got source code, which gives you full power to verify and look through and check all the code that you're installing. Now, realistically, you're not going to do that because there's a lot of code out there. A lot of it you don't understand. It might be saying echo virus into /bin in C, and you just don't recognize it. So not too sure if that's going to help you all that much. But again, the theory is that more people will see the code that way, and then they'll be able to tell everyone, hey, don't install this source, it's totally evil. But you do have MD5 SOMs, GPG keys that you can verify all of this stuff with. And those seem to be, you know, fairly reliable because you've got this community of people who kind of are watching each other's backs. There's devs developing FOP and XML2 and things like that. And they've got their GPG keys right there, and they've signed the source code with their key. So you can verify those things. You have some kind of feeling that, yes, I know this group, and I know that within that group, they're looking at the code and they're keeping an eye on it. So this doesn't mean that you need to be warned by your OS that, hey, you downloaded this application from the internet. Are you sure you want to run it? Because if you think about that question, that's not the right question to ask at that point. The real question being asked there is, wherever you got this application, do you feel like there's some level of trust? It's not, hey, you downloaded it from the internet. Are you sure you want to run it? Yes, I want to run it. I clicked on the icon. I double-clicked on the icon. I'm triple-clicking on the icon. Obviously, I want to run the software. I don't care from whence it came. So the question is, do you trust the code that you've installed? And that's not something that you ask when you click on the application to run the application. That's something that you ask when you install the thing. There's that. Now, if you're doing the whole repository thing, this is a great way of doing things. I mean, at first, it kind of freaked me out. I thought repositories are weird because they rely on servers off in the sky that I can't see, can't touch, I don't understand it. What if I'm on vacation, I don't have an internet, and I really, really need to install Synfig? How will I ever get it if I'm relying on the repository? To some degree, I'm sure I have some kind of point there, because in theory, if you downloaded the source code to Synfig, then and you know how to compile it, then you can always install it from source code. But I mean, either way, you had had to get that source code. So it doesn't really, I'm okay with the repositories now. And now that I even think about the alternatives, I'm like, wow, repositories are really, really good actually, because what we have is repositories of code, of packages that have been packaged by people who have a ring of trust around them. And they're being hosted on a, I hesitate to say the word vendor, but a group again, let's just say group, a group of, you know, a server belonging to a group that has, again, a ring of trust. We've got people in Fedora looking at the code, committing the code, okaying the commits. We've dealt with Fedora. We know that they can be trusted to whatever degree that they can be trusted. And we're, you know, it's a calculated risk, and it seems to work. It seems to be a lot of levels of redundancy and a lot of levels of people checking the code, especially when you think, well, here's this RPM and it's being maintained by this person, and oh, well, look at this. They've got lots of other RPMs being maintained by them as well. And, you know, you kind of get reputations, I guess, and it's the whole idea of meritocracy, I guess. And you kind of build up this level of trust. And if you're a responsible person, then people can, to some degree, trust you. And I don't guess any Linux geek is ever going to say, or even generically Unix geek is ever going to say, oh, I trust this person completely. I will install any bit of code they throw my way. I just don't care. They're just that great. Because obviously anyone could be a spy from the feds, right? I mean, we're all paranoid. That's why we're into Linux. So, okay. But there is that level of trust. And it really, really works, because when you install the RPM, you have a level of certainty that it comes from a reliable source. Now, in terms of ease of installing, honestly, I don't love any of the installers that I've seen. I believe I can say that, actually. I don't love any of the installers. There is a BSD, I think it's PCBSD, I think is what it was. And they had a cool little installer, and I think I talked about this in a much, much earlier episode, sometime in season 5 or 4. They've got a really nice little install wizard kind of thing going on. And I mentioned this to, I think it was Monster B, and he kind of didn't like it because he said it smacked of Windows. I didn't really see that because I wasn't used to Windows installers. I didn't really know what they looked like. But it did strike me as being very friendly and very, very simple and very standardized. And that I did like. I think they were like PBX packages or something like that. I don't really remember it clear enough now to be able to praise it or critique it. I do remember it being pretty darn easy. But on Fedora, I do know that when I click on an RPM, for instance, from, let's say, Synfig Studios site, I click on an RPM, it opens up automatically in a pop-up window that says, would you like to install this package from Synfig Studio? And if I say, yes, I want to install it, then it can open that in some kind of package kit installer, and it gives me all the different warnings that it wants to give me about the source of the application. You click OK, and it installs. How is this any different than the Windows installer? Well, to some degree, it's not, except that you have to have root permission to be able to actually install the application. So there you go. There's your authentication that Windows does not have, that Mac does, but that doesn't necessarily always work on Mac. And this actually functions as expected on Linux, which is nice. And depending on where you're getting this RPM from, yeah, it's a breakdown of, you know, whether you really trust it or not. But I wanted the latest code, and they've got their GPG keys right there, and so you can import their key. And I'd been following them long enough that I decided that I was going to just install their RPM and not sweat it. But, yeah, I mean, I think the ease of installing on Linux, I think it's fine. And, frankly, I can't get into complaining about installation methods on Linux. I think that it's pretty solid. It's got the right balance of it's easy enough to make it possible for a fairly modestly new user to install stuff, and yet at the same time it's got just enough of a barrier of entry that you kind of have to know what you're doing, which, frankly, I don't think that Windows seems to have at all, from what, you know, from the one time that I've sat in front of it and installed some applications, or maybe two times. So, yeah, I'm feeling pretty good about the installation methods that Linux has going on with it. All right, probably just one really quick last train of thought that I've got. I've been using way more than I want to Mac OS X lately. Not myself, but I've been administering it, I should say. And it's been interesting because on the one hand, I've actually been learning a lot about shell scripting. I've been doing a lot more complex shell scripts, as I mentioned in the last episode, because I refuse to deal with OS X on its own terms, and so I'm forcing it to work for me the way that Unix should work. Now, the one exception to this seems to be the way that OS X has been managing its permissions, and this to me is really, really interesting and really, I think it tells an important sort of moral lesson. And the morality tale here, the end result, is that when you don't have faith in time-tested Unix tools and methodology, bad things happen. And this can be a broad moral lesson for Unix and Linux and BSD and everything else users, because it is something that I think a lot of distributions continually attempt to sort of build upon. You know, they keep wanting to make things that they keep chasing this mythical quote-unquote user-friendliness. And for some reason, this quote-unquote user-friendliness seems to very, very frequently, perhaps all too often, require things sort of heaped up upon the Unix system. Now, Unix has been around for a long time, and it's worked really, really well, and it continues to work. And even the things that aren't Unix, in fact, GNU is not Unix. All this stuff, it works really well. And on the most basic level, I might even use, for instance, let's just choosing a distribution at random, Slackware, as an example. One of its primary goals, one of its actual mission statement, if you look on the website, is to keep the distribution as Unix-like as possible. This starts with things like the BSD init system, the RC.d kinds of traditions that you've got from BSD, and then you've got inherited into Slackware. It goes into doing things. The very system itself is built on tools that are simply, it builds itself, essentially, is what I'm trying to say. It's Slack builds, and install PKG, and things like that to package the distribution that they then put together, right? All those are shell scripts. It's nothing fancy. It's not even a Perl tool. It's not a Python tool. It's a shell script, for crying out loud. So the whole thing is just it's built from the ground up on very traditional Unix-y kinds of tools and traditions. And again, if you haven't read the Unix, Linux and the Unix Philosophy book by Mike Gancars, I think, then I urge you again to do so, because it's a great book and it really breaks down why this method of computing is so important. And I have to agree with it, because, you know, a schmuck like me I'm making shell scripts that actually do cool things, like my screenplay tools stuff, which has basically changed the way that I use Emacs and that I write screenplays or deal with screenplays at all. And so they're obviously, the tools are all there, and the logic of the system is there. And when you start to try to heap a whole bunch of new stuff on top of it, that's not a bad thing, obviously. We should be able to build on top of it. But when you're trying to replace or augment the parts that already work completely fine, I think really breakage happens. And a perfect example of this would be the OS X operating system, Mac OS X. Actually, I could just end right there, couldn't I? I could finish the whole segment, and that would probably be enough. But I should give you some specific examples, I guess, to make it complete. So OS X has this issue, a couple of issues. One being, for instance, the fact that a Samba share, like if you set up a Samba share, which is, you know, a pretty traditional office kind of shared storage methodology, and it's fairly popular because lots of different systems can talk to it. So you can set up a Samba share on a spare Linux server, or any kind of Samba share, really, but obviously I would be doing it on a Linux server. And OS X, for some reason, just won't respect the create mask and the directory mask. It just doesn't do it. Just doesn't play that game, doesn't play along with it. It's supposed to, you understand. It's not some declaration that OS X made. We will not use Samba in the traditional way. It's a bug. It's broken. This kind of confused me, and there are some hacks around it, and it's still not working, but okay, there you go. I'm sure there's an answer. You know, I mean, that's not all that unique. I mean, it's software, you know. It's not going to work exactly perfectly all the time. So, okay. But the other interesting issues related to this have been things like creating multiple users on one computer, which, you know, I mean, considering that this is a Unix system, which was designed from the ground up to be a multi-user system, it seems like not such a big deal to be creating new users on the system. Even worse would be creating a user on a different partition. So if you've got a separate partition for each user or a separate folder that you want to define as their home directory that is not in the /users directory. Again, these are all like normal things that you should be able to do, and if you were truly using Unix, then it would completely be possible, and it is possible. But OS X has this new layer of attributes that they heap on top of the traditional Unix permissions. And these attributes seem to be something that, for instance, the Finder looks to, more so and possibly exclusive of the Unix permissions, the traditional, you know, 755 or 777, 644, whatever, read, write, execute kind of permissions, and even the ownership, chown, klaatu, colon, staff in OS X terms. It just doesn't, the GUI doesn't seem to respect those permissions all that much. To some degree it does, but in other places, like on Samba shares and non-traditional home directories or user directories, it just doesn't do that. And I see this as a consequence of saying, okay, well, here's a perfectly fine working Unix system, and now we're going to build upon it and make it act completely differently. Another example of that, I would argue, would be a fairly popular Linux-based phone platform. But this phone platform seems to not really have a concept of multi-users. And hey, if there's an extension or an application or something, an app, I think is what they're called, for that, then feel free to let me know. But, you know, how many times has someone asked to use your phone and you hand it to them and they want to check their email and then they're logging into your Gmail and then they open your Gmail because it's already logged in? You know, all these other things. And it's a Linux-based platform, supposedly. Why isn't there a multi-user setup on this thing? So this is going down a path, and we see these problems. We see them in OS X, we see them in other platforms, and I would even argue that we see them in some modern distributions. I'm not going to name any names, but certainly some of the quote-unquote user-friendly distributions are really starting to add a lot of weird sort of like extra helpful tools that simply, I think, as they develop more and more, are going to introduce newer and newer problems, because I'm sure that the OS X developers did not intend for it to be a hassle to install an application without being warned constantly that you downloaded it from the internet or that you you don't have the correct permission to write to a preference file or that you're not able to write a file into a directory because you don't have a read permission. You know, why would you need read to write? Doesn't seem to make any sense. But there you go. These are issues. And like I say, you don't really go in thinking about these issues or knowing that it's going to be a problem. But it wouldn't be a problem if you were simply relying on the technology that already exists, that already works, and has worked for a very long time. So it's reinventing the wheel with the under the guise of being better and friendlier and more helpful. Not really. You know, just because a user doesn't understand something doesn't mean that you're not being helpful. It just means that your user doesn't understand something. There's probably a better way to help them understand the technology other than trying to reinvent the wheel, make it friendlier, and in the process, of course, completely breaking it. Okay, I think that was pretty much the final segment, but I still need to talk about just a couple of different things. One is the Linux Fest. So this month, this very month, is the Indiana Linux Fest. It's going to be really, really neat, really, really fun. You should try to go. I think I'm giving some kind of multimedia talk there or something. I'm not sure. I'll throw something together, I guess. If you can go there and kind of support the first yearedness of it, I think that might be kind of neat, especially if you're the type of person to sit around for 6 months out of the year thinking, gee, there's not enough Linux Fests out there. I'd really love to go to a Geek Fest right now, but there's just not one around. Well, going to them will encourage them to continue. So if you can at all possibly go to the, for instance, Indiana Linux Fest in, I think it's Indiana, then it would be pretty cool. So go to indianalinux.org, I think, and we'll see what happens. Say hi to me if you see me. Let's see. Okay, Auteur-editor.info is the website of the Auteur project. The Auteur project is at a standstill right now, completely stalled, because the only person on the small team that was the auteur team, who knows how to code, which was Rowan Golfer, had to get back to work on a very important and very, very significant project called OpenMolar 2. OpenMolar 2, of course, is Rowan Golfer's sequel to the original OpenMolar, and it should be a lot more international, and it's got a better plugin structure so people can kind of expand on it and do cool things with it in different regions of the world, not just Scotland. So he's doing that, and you know, that's really important work, obviously, and he can't just sit around and play around with video editors all day. Me, myself, I'm doing little Python applications here and there. I did a timecode calculator recently. You can see that actually on getorius.org/simtycalc. Right now it's got a bug in it when you do subtraction. It allows your numbers to go into the negatives when it's not really supposed to go into the negatives yet. It's supposed to carry over and subtract from the other fields. So I've got some little bug in there for that, but it does the addition really well. Rowan Golfer actually helped me clean it up and make it prettier. It's a GUI tool, but I'm nowhere near video editing coding yet. So if you are a Python coder and you want something to work on, feel free to stop by the Auteur site, the Getorius repository, and check it out. Right now, Auteur is, you know, where it stands is that it's a marvelously stable editor. You can open it, you can open up pretty much any kind of video you want to in it. It's really, really powerful because of the InPlayer backend. And you can cut and dice up video footage and put it in an order. You can even modify the in and out points, and then you can export it. It doesn't have a terribly robust timeline as such. But it is an interesting project. You should check it out just for kicks. It's really, really cool. We have packages for Fedora and Debian and I think Arch. And I think someone actually packaged it for Mandriva just out of the blue. No one on our team, just some people. There are translations happening via like Ubuntu Launchpad thing. That's where Rowan Golfer has his code or something. Stuff is happening with it. There's obviously an ongoing interest in video editors on Linux. There's still that vague hope that Lightworks will come in and save us all. And then there's VLMC, which I actually did download the other day and try. I tried it out. It looks great. They're doing a fantastic job. I have high hopes for it. I still think that XML-based, InPlayer-driven video editing is where Linux really should go if they want to be anything like a contender to Final Cut or Avid or Smoke or whatever. But what do I know? I'm not a programmer, so who knows? Okay, that's Auteur. There's another Fat Chance Lester album has been released, just in case you thought I wasn't doing anything at all. I've been editing, of course, more Fat Chance Lester music. This one is called The Ruins of Earth. It features people who you will actually recognize. For instance, K5 Tux does a little bit of a voiceover on it. He's a futuristic announcer. And it's just one piece. It's 45 minutes long. It's a little bit dystopic, but a little bit happy as well. It's cool. I like it. I really do. It's a good little album. So go to astiopod.com/Lester, which would be AESDIOPOD.com/Lester. It's available in AUG, it's available in AAC, and available in FLAC. So that's the other Fat Chance Lester album for now. There's still quite a few to come, so by no means is this the final, but it's it is the one that's now released, so enjoy it, please. Okay, that's the end of the episode, so thanks for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can find me online at ogcastplanet.org/GNU World Order. You can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can instant message me at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can find me on Freenode, IRC, freenode.net, in the channel, Ogcast Planet, Slackware, OpenMolar, Auteur, Slacker Media, various channels having to do with Linux. And that's it. So thanks for listening, as always, and I will see you next time.
then we have lost. We will die on a strange planet in a strange galaxy.